Alrighty.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Love Fruit podcast. Today's guest is Lauren Whiteman, and Lauren has been following what she calls the natural human diet for the last 7 years, fruits, tender greens, small amounts of vegetables, nuts and seeds, and is a vegan. She also runs the group on Facebook, Terrain Model Refutes Germ Theory. Is that the correct name of the group?
Yeah, that's it.
I see you nodding your head. And we're going to talk to her today about her story, her thoughts, her ideas, and I think hopefully we'll learn a lot from you, Lauren. So thank you very much. Is there anything else you'd like to say about yourself in introduction?
I think we'll kind of cover it as we start talking. I've been on this path, on this journey for about 8 years now. I started out very, very sick and had a lot of chronic health issues and just felt like there was a better way, felt like there was, something missing that, we're not like designed to be sick. So I just started, researching and, found my way to the natural diet and, healed all of my health issues and then started taking in rescue dogs and started healing them as well, following the same principles. So.
Excellent. So you grew up in a fairly conventional lifestyle. And did you grow up in Texas? Is that where you're from?
No, I live in Texas now, but I actually grew up in New Jersey. I lived there 30 years. Definitely grew up in very standard American diet, a lot of cooked foods, a lot of processed foods. We always had the little Debbie and Hostess cakes and Twinkies and cupcakes and fruit roll-ups and all this food coloring filled. And, the extent of our fruit was, maybe an apple or, some bananas on rare occasion. It was always, my mom was always like, oh, it's fruit is too expensive. Can't afford it. So it was always a luxury item. We would get like watermelon in the summer and we'd be so excited about that. A lot of canned vegetables, lots of salt. I went vegetarian at age 11. To my parents' great consternation, they tried to convince me that I was, missing out on all the protein. But a friend of mine had gone on a religious trip to Australia. And for some reason during that trip, they thought it was a good idea to take 11 and 12 year olds to a slaughterhouse. And so my friend came back and she told me all about it. And from that day forward, I was like, okay, well, I can't ever eat another animal because they're animals. I can't eat meat because that's an animal. And so from that point forward, I kind of had a battle with my parents about, eating meat and, just like going against the conventions, the standard, dietary advice of the medical industry and all of that.
And do you remember, so that was when you went vegetarian. Do you remember what were the other steps you made along the journey towards a fruitarian diet?
Sure. Yeah. Like I said, I started about 11 on a vegetarian diet, but I didn't really eat much in the way of milk and eggs, like outright, but if there was like a processed food item that had them in them, I would continue to eat those things. But I never really made the connection between food and health. Like that was not within the realm of information that was available to me at that time. So it wasn't until I was in college, his father gave me a book by John Robbins, The Diet for a New America. And that was the first kind of introduction I had to the idea that our health was connected to the food that we eat. And so, prior to that, I was vegetarian, but I was like a junk food vegetarian. I used to call myself a pastatarian. So I would just eat so much pasta and bread and, wheat. And then I ended up developing IBS because of that. So I had, IBS for about 10 years. And, I would eat, I started looking at like mainstream healthy. So I would eat like whole grains and You know, I made all of my meals at home. I wasn't eating out at fast food restaurants or anything like that, but I still wasn't getting better. You know, I would like my, I would say like my decline kind of slowed, but I wasn't, nothing was improving in my health. And then one day I saw on YouTube the video Dairy is Scary, and I went vegan immediately because I was like, I had always, I think most people who are vegetarians associate, you know, dairy as being not cruel, as being, you know, something that's, you know, we just naturally get it. They, cows, for some reason, we think that cows produce extra milk, you know, even though no other species on the planet produces extra milk. Right. We think that that cows do. And, you know, so I was under those same delusions. And then, you know, I found the video Dairy is Scary on YouTube, and, you know, just instantly I was just woke up and I was just like, okay, well, never going to eat dairy or eggs again. So now I'm vegan and, you know, still just keep moving the whole time, like closer towards like a whole foods, plant-based diet, lots more vegetables, lots less processed food. And then I found a golf ball size mass in my breast. And I was like, okay, I need to get serious. Like my health is continuing to decline. You know, I'm following all the mainstream advice and it's just not working. Like, what is wrong here? What's the missing piece? So I love to read. So I went to the library and I just started looking down the aisles and I stumbled across a book by Victoria Batenko. It was her raw family book. And I immediately resonated with me. I was like, well, of course, like we're cooking our food, we're denaturing our food, we're processing our food. Like none of this is real or natural. It's all, you know, just compromised. And so if we put something compromised into our body, we're gonna just become compromised. I mean, we are what we eat. So I started to just read more and more. Like I went back to the library just week after week and looked for all the raw food books, raw food, transitional books, raw recipe guides, just all of that. And eventually I found, T.C. Fry and Herbert Shelton's books. And that's when things like really started to make sense for me. That's when things really started to click.
That's a pretty good library you had there.
Oh yeah. 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 It's this was when I was in Las Vegas and they have like a fairly good library system. So you can actually get books from all around the valley. Yeah. So yeah, I'm actually thinking back on it now. It's surprising that there's that much available there, but there is, you know, they're just hidden away on the shelves and you just, you know, you'll never know what you find when you wander into a library. So.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. So you were you basically trying to work it out on your own then?
Oh yeah. Yeah. I mean, I was not at this time, I had not been on Facebook. I only joined Facebook 3 years ago. Or I think maybe 4 years ago now. I, you know, would search some stuff on the internet, but mostly I was, you know, just kind of sheltered. Like I was in a very bad relationship and I wasn't allowed to socialize. And I didn't really have friends and I wasn't really, I didn't get out much. So like my one escape, my one way out, like was to go to the library and I would get books and I would read a ton. So most of my, you know, early research just stemmed from reading books and stuff like that. But then, you know, eventually I got on Facebook and I discovered like this whole world of, there's like the Dr. Morris groups was, I think the first raw food group I think was Dr. Morris. That's what I stumbled upon. And then, you know, just kind of started searching out. I was like, oh, there's this stuff out here. What else is out there? And so I started searching and found like all the fruitarian groups and the natural hygiene groups. And it just kind of blossomed from there. And now I run a giant group, which
is, we'll get to that, but how easy or quick was your transition towards the fruitarian style of diet? Did that happen quite quick when you started learning about it, or did it take some time, and how did you make that change?
So I would say it was more like a roller coaster. Like I was very scared about my health when I found that mass in my breast. And so I was like, okay, I'm going full force. So I did, I think I found a book by, it's Annie, I'm not sure how to pronounce her last name. It's Phyo or Pho. It's P-H-Y-O. But she had a book. I think it's, she renamed it, but it used to be called, I think, the 15-day fat blast or something like that. But it was just like a 15-day smoothies and raw food and salads. And she had like a grocery list and menus and all of that. And so that was the first thing that I did that, like, I went fully raw. I just did the 15 days. And her plan, it's, you know, a little more nut centered, a little higher fat. So, you know, I think it's a great way. I would actually recommend it to people. It's a great way to transition because, you know, so much of our cravings are just emotional suppressant, and fat is a great emotional suppressant. So, you know, as we work through these cravings and we work through the emotional issues that we're kind of like unearthing as we start to eat fruit, you know, having the little bit of extra fat helps us to stay away from going back to cooked foods. And also just the calorie density, you know, we're used to eating small, very calorie dense, but nutrient poor meals when we eat a cooked food diet. And then, you know, when we transition to eating fruit, we need to eat much larger volumes. And so I think, you know, one of the biggest things that people struggle with when they first get started is just eating that volume, or just even just changing their mindset to be able to eat that volume. Yeah. I know when I talk to like my parents, they're always like, how do you eat that much? And like, I eat like a 5-pound, 7-pound salad. And you know, they're like, they've got like this little like cereal bowl full of salad and they're like, I'm full. I'm like, that's not going to cut it. You're not going to survive on that.
Is that something, was eating more something you had to adjust to?
Oh, definitely. Yeah. I mean, when I struggled with anorexia as a child, and, you know, I struggled with my weight a lot as a kid. I ran track and I did all of these things to try to like maintain a healthy weight, but like all the food that was going into my body was just everything that the body wanted to create fat out of, because it was just so full of toxins, and the body just creates fat to store toxins. So if you're just putting all those toxins in, you know, your body just wants to create fat. And so I constantly struggled with like self-esteem issues and things like that. And, you know, so I had a lot of eating disorder issues. And so for me, there was a huge mental hurdle as well as a physical hurdle to get over that, the idea of just eating, like, you know, the idea of eating till you're satisfied. Like, there's always so much in the mainstream about like restricting, you know, cutting your calories, you know, don't eat, portion control, you know, intermittent fasting, and all of these things that are basically like, be disciplined and eat less. And, you know, when you eat the natural diet, it's eat more, you know, it's eat till you're full, because your body is just craving those nutrients. And then once you get, you know, like, I like to think you're catching up, you know, like your body, for so many years, you spent like, you know, 30 or 40 years eating a cooked food diet that was just devoid of nutrition. So when you first start, your body's just like, ooh, nutrients, I want them. And, you know, so just fill your body up. And then over time, you'll find that your appetite actually, you know, shrinks down a little bit, and you kind of fall into like lower volumes of food, but, you know, still going to be larger volumes than if you're eating, you know, cooked foods, or, you know, heavy starches or proteins and things like that.
You mentioned a problem with anorexia at one point. Do you have any idea of how did you manage to get over that?
I would say that, like, anorexia, and I also had suicidal depression. I had like manic episodes, and all of that, you know, I understand now, it's all physical. Those are physical problems. Those are like, mental health issues are physical health issues. This is, it's a lack of nutrition in the body. It's the toxicity of the body that is causing all of these issues. You know, often we find that, you know, if somebody eats a cooked food meal, they get anxiety, you know, and then they have an elimination and the anxiety stops, you know, because as soon as it's eliminated from the colon, the body's no longer in distress. So much of what we feel from an emotional standpoint is actually created by what we eat. It's created by literally the body trying to communicate to us that it is in distress. So like, most of our emotions are actually just our body in distress from the things that we're putting into it, and our body trying to communicate that to us. And, you know, we've just been taught, because, you know, before we can even speak or think about our feelings, we are as infants, fed all of these emotionally suppressing foods, and we kind of create this like cycle of addiction. So we reward babies on their birthday with some of the harshest drugs known to man, wheat flour and refined sugar. And we, we know now, like when we look at like the neurological studies, that feeding white sugar is like feeding cocaine to a baby. You know, it's the same level of like addiction that we're creating. So, we're creating all of these patterns of both malnutrition. We're giving refined foods, foods that are isolated, foods that are fractionated, foods that have been damaged, and they just don't provide the nutrition the body needs. And we're also, feeding these things that are irritating to the body. And so we're just creating this constant cycle of like irritation, and then the body starts to come down, and then we want to hype the body back up again. Because we're just used to that low level stress that our body is under when we're eating all of these things that are just damaging to the body. So, what I found was the more I ate real food, whole foods, fruits, the less those feelings existed. I didn't have the damage going through my digestive tract, so I wasn't in a state of constant anxiety. I didn't have, I wasn't drugging my body into depression, so I wasn't feeling depressed. I wasn't, I was maintaining my weight at a natural weight and a healthy weight because I wasn't feeding my body things that it wants to create fat from. So I like those feelings of like not being able to, like the anorexic, desire came from, in part the mental, physical, chemical imbalances in the body, but it also came from a frustration of not being able to maintain a natural healthy weight. And, when you just start eating your natural diet, that becomes effortless. Your body just returns to its natural weight because there's nothing for it to be creating fat over. There's no toxins that it wants to wrap up inside fat. There's nothing, you're not overindulging the body in oils and refined carbs that are going to trigger the liver to store fat. So we eliminate all of the underlying causes. And when you eliminate the cause of disease, the disease goes away.
So you found those, the groups, various groups on Facebook and so on. And do you have any major, what would you say were the best, did you come across any specific teachers or anyone, did you meet anyone in your own life that helped you out? Was there any books in particular that were the most important guide to you in that journey?
Yeah, and it's going to be a little weird because it's not a fruit group. The group that I learned the most from was actually a group on rotational monofeeding for dogs. And it's run by Nora Lentz, and she's a natural hygienist. And she had run, she ran the website, she still does, rawschool.com. And she kind of reached a point where she was like, people are too frustrating to work with because, we have all of these emotional eating patterns and everybody wants to argue with you. And she said, but, dogs, we can heal dogs so easily because a dog, if you put down a bowl of kibble or you put down a bowl of real food in front of the dog doesn't care. The dog's going to eat it. Dog's going to eat whatever you put down in front of them. So we can heal dogs so easily by giving them bowls of fruit and giving them, their natural diet. And, so she was like, just frustrated with the whole, dealing with people thing. So she wrote a book on the natural dog diet. And what happened was I was in the Dr. Morris groups and I had taken in a dog that had a grapefruit sized tumor on her spleen. She was a foster and she had vestibular disease. She was partially blind. She had hearing loss. She was 24 pounds when her healthy weight was 13 pounds. She had just terrible health conditions. The vet basically said, so the rescue or the shelter told me, she's got terminal cancer. We're just looking for somebody that can foster her for the end of her days. And then, we took her over to the rescue's vet and the vet said, she's got, somewhere between a week and maybe 2 or 3 weeks, maybe a month at best. And they said, they basically just said, there's nothing we can do for her. Bring her back when you want to euthanize her. And I was just like, no, uh-huh. like I'm not giving up on this dog. Like that's like, no. So I started like asking, reaching out to people in the Dr. Morris groups and you know, somebody directed me to Nora's group, and I got her ebook and I read it in like 45 minutes, and I went out to the store and I got all the fruits and everything. And I started her on the natural diet for dogs. And, you know, we just watched her just get better. And, you know, I mean, she lived another 2.5 years. She passed in old age. She lost all of the weight. She got her hearing back. She got her sight back. She, like we used to go running for.
This is amazing. So what were you feeding the dog?
So, we started out with, watermelon for the first 30 days. Then we did an 11-day water fast. And then, we transitioned her to the natural diet that I feed all of my dogs, which is, about 60% fruit and then 40% raw meat. And we move to, as they get older, we move to more plant days and less meat. So with the seniors or the dogs with chronic disease, we often feed meat only like once a week or every 2 weeks. And then the rest is all just fruits. They eat like bananas, mangoes, papaya, watermelon, you know, all the melons, cucumbers, apples, pears, peaches, plums, anything that you can eat, you know, fruit wise, that's what the dogs can eat. And that's their natural diet. You know, if you look at nature, look at all the canid families, the wolves, the coyotes, the wild dogs, all of them eat between 40 and 83% fruits, depending on the season. So if you look at like the wild wolves of Yellowstone, they eat, they've done studies on the stool samples of the wild wolves of, there's a Voyager Wolf Project in Minnesota, and then there's the Yellowstone Project. And like in the summer in Yellowstone, when the berries are all in season, it makes up 83% of their diet. They eat like plums. They'll find like the plum pits in the stool, stuff like that. They eat persimmons, just any kind of wild fruits that are out there. They're eating it. So
I've never had anyone associate fruit with a dog's natural diet before. I've never heard that.
Yeah. And, you know, and that's the misinformation that's out there, is that, you know, even if you look at the raw food diets for dogs, like the kind of mainstream ones, you've got the BARF, which is supposed to be biologically appropriate raw food. And then you've got the PMR, which is prey model raw. You know, prey model raw doesn't include any plants. And the BARF model is, it includes some plants, but it's like just tiny amounts of plants, and they're mixing it with the protein. And, you know, I always explain to people is dogs only have one stomach. They can't digest a protein and a carb at the same time, just like we can't. You know, if we put a, you know, steak and potatoes into our digestive system's going to be sluggish, and we're going to feel tired and weighed down because the body is just struggling to get that digested because, well, I mean, obviously meat is not a suitable food for the human physiology. But it's just, you know, you're mixing two things that the stomach acids are going to neutralize each other. So, you know, a dog out in the wild would never, you know, go catch a wild prey and then stop what it's doing and go pick some carrots and then go pick some blueberries and then go over to the mango tree and then bring it all together and combine it into a meal. But in order to sell kibble and to sell commercial foods, they have to convince us that that's natural and normal, because, you know, in order for them to sell kibble, they need to have all the fillers. They need to, you know, get everything into one shelf stable bag. And so they create this idea that, you know, dogs need just a little bit of plants, and it needs to be primarily meat, and it needs to be, you know, all mixed together and balanced or scientifically formulated, or, you know, all of these other marketing terms that they use. And so, you know, it's a combination of both the misinformation coming out of the marketing for these products, as well as the misinformation that kind of abounds in the human health, which is this, you know, crazy idea that we need this excessive amount of protein all the time. You know, because like, what's the first question that every vegan gets? Where are you going to get your protein from, though? You know, it, like, we have this mental, just block where we've just been so drilled into our head that we need this excessive amount of protein, which, you know, this excessive amount of protein is why we have chronic disease. But, you know, everybody's going around saying, oh, we need protein, we need protein. So we automatically only see what we want to see, you know, we cognitive bias, we see what, you know, already fulfills the ideas that we want fulfilled. So, you know, we look at nature and we see, you know, the wolf catching a prey and we say, oh, wolves eat animals. It's like, but we didn't look any closer because, you know, you don't see wolves out, you know, walking through the berry bush. You're not really looking for that. But as soon as you go looking for it, as soon as you start analyzing their stool and saying, let's take this like a scientific approach to this, let's actually look objectively at this, you know, we start to see, you know, yeah, oh, look, there's, you know, 10,000 blueberry seeds in their poop. That means they ate wow. X amount of volume of, you know, blueberries. You know, there's plum pits in their stool. So, you know, they made, you know, they ate this or, you know, like out, if you're walking through the trails out in Las Vegas, you'll see the coyote stool is always full of the mesquite pods. And they just, you know, they just chow down on those mesquite pods. It's a huge part of their diet, but we, you know, we want to push this idea within society that humans need protein. So we want to push the idea that everybody else that eats protein needs to only eat protein. And so we get this kind of level of misinformation out there that unfortunately is causing our dogs to be very sick.
I can imagine that most people would almost feel like it would be unsafe to feed their dogs fruit, or they would worry about giving their dogs fruit. And if I search online a little bit, I come across things that are like, I can see a thing here. I'm not sure what website this is. Dogs have no real need for fruits or vegetables, but an occasional fruit or veggie as a treat is okay. I'm not sure what website that is, but it's like some.
Yeah, it's just the level of misinformation out there.
The American Kennel Club, is that like? Is that a big dog group? Anyway,
they're basically a breeding. They are an association of all of the breeders, and you can just look at their history of actions to know that, you know, they don't have the best interest of dogs in general.
This information is amazing, though. I've never really come across what you're saying. This is really.
Yeah. And, you know, and it's unfortunate because, you know, if we look at the average age of death of a golden retriever in 1970, they were living to 17 years. And the average age of death in 2020 for a golden retriever is 9 years. So we have, by feeding the way that we feed, by feeding these commercial foods, we have cut the natural lifespan of dogs in half.
In just 50 years,
we have cut their natural lifespan in half. And the thing is, we can see this in our own health as well. You know, we've done the same thing to ourselves as we do to the dogs, but, you know, because dogs, live like shorter lifespans, we can see multiple generations over our own lifespan. We see exactly the degeneration that's happening within the human species. We can see magnified on a much, you know, faster gradient for, you know, as the human progress. And, you know, humans, we've cut our natural lifespan. You know, I mean, we know that humans can live at least 120 years. Most people believe, you know, within science, and there was just a big study out of Japan, I think it was, that, you know, basically came to the conclusion that the natural human lifespan is 150 to 160 years, seven times the rate of.
Where was that? Where's that study from?
You know, I'm not exactly sure where it was from. It just came up, and I've been trying to dig it back up again because I want to add it to my files. But I think it was a study out of Japan. But they were talking about, I didn't even get to, like, somebody, you know, mentioned it, and I was like, oh, I have to go look for it. And then, like, I just haven't had a chance to find it. But
I always wonder, though, as well, with some of these things, like, that, for example, maybe that is the potential for a human life. However, we've had however many thousands of years of probably genetic, like
degeneration.
Yeah, so it might take a few generations for that to start to come back, that level.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah,
I don't know, it's just an idea I'm putting out there, but I think that people forget that, like, we could, if the world goes on a fruitarian, fruit-based diet, we'd see a big shift straight away, but we might see an enormous shift in a few generations. We might see a totally different race of humans come out all of a sudden.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, you know, but get back to the dogs. I mean, that's honestly, I never really considered that or thought about that. But I have seen stuff recently about vegan dogs doing better and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. So, what do you think in general? I think you're saying rescuing dogs or something, but mm-hmm. generally, but as a vegan, what's your thoughts towards pets? Because I think vegans have different ideas about that. Some vegans are very against the idea.
Yeah, it's a very touchy subject in the vegan community.
Sure.
You know, the way that I see it is, I can't go in a time machine and go back to when humans domesticated dogs. So we have dogs out there that need us. You know, human beings have created this situation where they are dependent upon us. And, you know, so it is our responsibility to be, you know, the stewards to, you know, like, you know, as the Bible says, we have dominion over them. That means protection. It means we have been put in place by God to be, you know, their protectors, to be the protectors of all animal life. So, you know, if we have created as a society, as a species, we've created this problem, like, I don't feel like we have the moral right to walk away and just say, oh, well, you know, we'll just stop. You know, we're just going to stop doing this. Like, it's not realistic. You know, we have all of these dogs out here. We have all these cats out here that have been bred specifically in order to be domesticated and are not capable of surviving out on their own. And so we can't just say, oh, well, we're just going to give up on them. So, you know, I don't believe in breeding dogs. I don't believe that there is any, I don't think there's any reasonable justification for breeding a dog. I mean, every life that you breed is directly correlated to a life that's going to die in the shelter. And, you know, I don't know what the shelter rates are like in your country, but here in the US, we murder 1.5 million dogs every year in shelters.
Wow. Right.
Because, you know, and there is one reason why we do that. And that is because people are going to a breeder instead of going to the shelter. If everybody who bought a dog from the breeder went to the shelter instead, our shelters would be empty overnight. You know, we have to start looking at things that, you know, really work versus what we want them to work. Like, we use the spay and neuter program here in the US. We have the highest rates of euthanasia. When we look at countries like Norway and Sweden, I'm not sure which one of them, but one of them actually outlaws spay and neuter programs because it's abusive to the dog. And they have empty shelters. So, you know, we need a shift to personal responsibility. We need a shift to the responsibility of the human to, you know, fix these problems that we ourselves have created. And we need to stop looking for these like shortcuts, you know, and it's the same thing that we need in the human health realm. It's like, we need to stop running to, you know, the disease for profit industry and giving them our money in order to, for them to sell us toxic chemicals. We need to take personal responsibility for our health and remove the cause of our discomfort, remove the cause of our disease, or we're never going to get out of these epidemics of disease. You know, you can't poison a body back to health. You know, you can't, you know, put the responsibility on a cat or dog when the problem is the responsibility of, you know, lack of responsibility of the human. So, you know, and I know it's a touchy subject. I know a lot of people, you know, yeah, just like, you know, no, I'm vegan, I'm not going to own animals. And, you know, I agree. I don't think that you should own animals. I don't think you should call them pets. I think they are our family. I think they are our companions. And I think that we have, you know, a duty to protect them. And I think that we need to, you know, take responsibility, even if it's not our responsibility directly. You know, like I've worked in customer service my whole life. And one of the things that, you know, it doesn't matter what company you work for, you're always taught about like apologizing, even if it wasn't your fault. You know, it goes a long way. It makes a difference. You know, if just because the other person isn't taking responsibility doesn't mean that we can't. So, you know, the way I see it is, you know, all of these dogs that end up in the shelter, if I have the ability to help them, I'm going to help them, because it's not their fault that they're there. It's, you know, some other human who wasn't responsible. So.
Sure. Sure. Let's go back to the diet then and everything. And what would be like a typical day for you?
For me, so I usually try to start my day with, and I go back and forth. Like I always feel better when I don't eat until after about 11 o'clock or noon, and then I stop eating between 6 and 7 p.m. So typically I try to eat a large fruit meal in the morning around 11, 12, and then a like a very large salad. Like I usually do maybe 5 pound, 6 pound salad around 5-ish, somewhere around there, so that I'm able to wind down for the night. But when I like I'm just like anybody else, like when I'm stressed out, sometimes I emotionally eat. So I might like get up in the morning, be stressed out, and go eat, make a smoothie or do something that's not exactly ideal. And I try to recognize that and just be kind to myself and make sure that I stop doing those things when the symptoms start getting bad enough. If you start waking up the next morning feeling groggy, I'm like, okay, I really got to push my meals back to, after 11 so that I, can get back to feeling my best. But yeah, an average day is a large fruit meal in the morning, usually maybe 4 to 5 pounds of fruit. And then in the evening, a large salad.
Just two large meals.
Yeah, I generally just eat two. Sometimes I just eat one. It depends on, how active. Like if I'm just working at my computer all day, I'm not burning a lot of calories. So I might just eat like a bowl of oranges and just that would be it for the day. But it took me a while to get there. That's not how I started. I started with like the raw till four type program where I was doing like fruit meal, and then like a little bit of cooked food with a salad. I would do like a salad first and then like a little bit of cooked food. And then, I slowly pushed that cooked food out and worked my way to just the fruit and salad, and I was doing two fruit meals and a salad. And then, now I don't eat as much as I used to because my body's just, had that time to heal and catch back up. My digestive tract is healed, so it's able to be a lot more efficient with the food that I am giving it. And so it was very much a gradual process. I would say probably like over 3 or 4 years that I worked towards that two meals a day.
Okay. And do you take any supplements or anything additional like that?
No, natural hygiene teaches us that supplements are harmful to the body as well as herbs. So we don't use any herbs, no onion, no garlic, no irritants like salt. Salt is a biocide, it kills our cells. Nothing that stimulates the body. So no cocoa, no coconut oil or anything like that, which is, kind of prevalent in the raw food communities. It's like your foods should not create irritation within your body. So like no spicy peppers, anything that tastes bitter. Bitter is our senses telling us that that's a poison. So we want to avoid bitter, sour, spicy, salty. Those are all our, natural physiological senses telling us when something is toxic to the body. So just fruits and salad greens mostly. And then I will eat like nuts and seeds and like maybe some asparagus or something like that on occasion, but it's very rare these days. I don't really like eating nuts or avocado because if I eat like 2 days in a row, avocado or nuts or seeds or some combination of them, I'll start to get symptoms immediately. I'll get itchy ears, my scalp will get itchy, my face will get dry, because the fat blocks the uric acid from being expelled by the body. So it slows down our body's ability to release acids. So, at this point, my body has become so sensitive to these things that I'm able to immediately recognize the symptoms when I've kind of moved away from things that are as ideal as we should be eating.
Okay, and let's go on to your group. So when did you start or take over this group, and what happens in the group? What do you discuss and so on?
Yeah, so it all started before the current political situation that's been going on for the last 2 years that we're not really allowed to talk about. So the group was originally run by somebody else, and he had gotten banned from Facebook. And so the group, we had 140 members, and the group is talking about how we had two theories of disease. We had the terrain theory of disease, and we had the germ theory of disease. And the germ theory of disease is what the for-profit disease industry ran with, because it allows them to sell their antibiotics and other injections and things like that. And so we talk about what the terrain model of disease is, how natural hygiene has proven that true over the past 150 years of rigorous science, and how our bodies are self-cleaning and self-healing, and how the suppression of symptoms is actually what drives us into these chronic levels of disease. So we talk about, you know, what detox processes are, how the body heals, why the natural diet leads to resolution of health conditions, and why eating an unnatural diet creates health conditions. We talk about the anatomy and physiology of the human body, and how that shows us what our natural human diet is. And we also talk about, kind of the cellular functions. And so we talk about, you know, what's actually creating this disease. So when we go to the disease industry, the for-profit disease industry, they have all of these hundreds of thousands of disease labels for, you know, you've got heart disease, or you've got diabetes, or you've got cancer, or you've got, you know, some genetic disease or whatever. So we break down what the disease label means, and we explain how each disease label is not an actual disease, but it's a collection of symptoms that are bound together so that they can be labeled as a disease, so that legally the medical industry can sell patented poisons to legally give to the patients. So that's like the medical model is basically a doctor cannot prescribe their medicine, which medicine by definition, if you look at the etymology of that, is poison. It's pharmakia. Pharmakia is poison or sorcery or witchcraft. So we look at, so legally, in order for them to sell that to the customer, they have to have a patented disease label. So when we look at that, that's, you know, how the medical industry works. So you have a symptom, you have a collection of symptoms. They look up the collection of symptoms. They say, okay, well, that's this disease label, and we can give you this drug for that disease label to suppress your symptoms. And then when that drug creates symptoms, we can give you this other drug to make more to suppress the other symptoms. And, you know, so that's how, you know, people, they end up on 15 or 20 different drugs, because each different drug is creating a different side effect. And then we have to treat that side effect, we have to suppress the symptoms of that side effect. So the terrain model is essentially the polar opposite of that model of disease. So in the terrain model, we say remove the cause of disease and the symptoms of disease will go away. So when we look at the underlying causes, the diet, the lifestyle choices, and we remove those and return back to a natural diet, we see that the, you know, body goes through a period of detox. Just like if a drug addict goes to a detox center, you know, we know that the heroin addict goes into the detox center and they get really sick, they get flu-like symptoms, they get cold symptoms. As the body cleans itself, the body is expelling waste. So the same thing happens when we change our diet. When we are putting in a whole bunch of waste creating foods, we create a buildup of waste. And then when we start to lessen that burden on the body, the more we lessen the burden, the more energy the body has to expel and clean itself. So when we go back to the natural diet of fruits, and where it's low digestive energy, low drain on the body has a lot more energy available to clean itself. And so the body creates colds and flus in order to expel all of this waste. So we basically teach the detox processes and, you know, how it actually works, how the body actually works versus, you know, how the medical industry sells their model of disease.
Interesting. Do you think there's any situation in which medicine is helpful or useful?
I think we have emergency medicine, you know, we have surgeries. I think when we're not suppressing symptoms, the thing is we have a self-healing, self-cleaning body. So if the body is creating a symptom and we are suppressing that symptom, then we are working against the body. So anywhere where the medical industry is working against the body, that's ultimately going to lead to further creation of disease conditions. But, you know, there's obviously always situations in which the medical industry is going to be, you know, useful in like emergency medicine. If you get into a car accident and, you know, you have like a severely broken bone that needs to be put back into place, or, you know, you have, you know, something happens like catastrophic, like a punctured organ, you know, being stitched back together, you know, there's definitely places where the medical industry is, you know, useful. But, you know, when we're looking at, you know, what is creating disease, if we're not removing the cause, we're not going to solve the problem. I mean, what other problems in life do we solve by leaving the cause in place and then just putting band-aids over it? So, you know, if anywhere that the medical industry is not removing cause, they're not, you know, really working with the body, they're working against the body. So
I guess if a medicine was removed, was helping to remove the cause, then it might be helpful in that situation.
A medicine can never remove cause, right? So cause is occurs before the medicine. Medicine just changes your internal chemistry. There's no way for medicine to remove cause. It can change the chemistry that changes the expression of symptoms. So like, you know, you have an ulcer on your arm and you can put an ointment on the arm, and instead of the body pushing the acids out, that it, you know, the reason that the body created the ulcer in the first place was to push the waste out. So it's, you know, if we put a cream over top of that, the body will stop creating it in that area because the body doesn't want that cream getting into the interior cavity of the body. So the body will close up that wound. But we haven't actually helped the body. All we've done is trap the waste inside because the body was trying to push that waste out. So if we create, you know, we can create a change in symptoms with medications, but we can't actually remove the cause. Does that make sense?
Well, if a person has a particular bacterial infection and the medication acts upon that bacteria.
Right. So that's germ theory. So bacteria inside of our body is created by our bodies. So we have pleomorphic bacteria. Our bacteria changes form. It goes from our healthy cell into a bacterial cell and into yeast cells, into fungus cells.
I'm not really talking about things in your body. I'm talking about, for example, if someone has Lyme's disease or something like that, or something external to the body that has come into the body that has become an infection in the body.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, so when you actually start to study the science on these things, you start to see where the holes are in the science. So Lyme's disease is actually just high level toxemia of the body. It's blamed on a parasite, but in reality, what is happening is the body is highly toxic. So bacteria, which creates infection within the medical industry, this is a medical term, is created when there is waste inside the body that needs to be dealt with, and the body creates bacteria in order to deal with this waste. So bacteria is a symptom of disease. Infection is a symptom of disease. They're not a cause. The cause is the underlying waste that the body is utilizing bacteria in order to clean. So bacteria in nature, everywhere we look in nature, bacteria is nature's recycling team. They break down larger particles into smaller particles to recycle the waste. So, you know, if an animal dies, bacteria goes to work on it. And in a few days, that body is broken all the way down into earth. That's bacteria at work. So everywhere that there is bacteria in the world, it is working on a recycling of dead tissue. So if we, you know, cut our arm, we might have, the body will send bacteria to the site of that wound. The bacteria, it didn't create the wound. The bacteria is there as a result of the wound. It's a symptom of the wound. The bacteria is there to break down the debrided tissue, the tissue that's been damaged, and to recycle it so that the body can create new and healthy cells. So, you know, our body is constantly recycling cells. It's constantly taking a damaged cell and taking the parts and pieces of it and breaking it apart, and then recycling those down into the smallest usable particles so that they can be reused and built into new and healthy cells. So that's what bacteria does in our body. It goes to the site of a wound and it creates, you know, it recycles the damaged tissues so that the body can repair them. So the medical industry, or the germ theory, has presented this idea that these bacteria that we know now are created by the body are outside invading forces. And so this is, you know, when Pasteur, you know, originally created his idea of germ theory, he had, you know, scientists who disagreed with him. But just like we see, you know, in today's world, like we have doctors out there that are pushing, you know, meat, dairy, and eggs, you know, because they have a certain agenda. You know, same thing happened 150 years ago. You know, there's money and agendas everywhere. And so the information that drives those agendas is what is put out by those who want to push the agenda. So, you know, the disease industry is a for-profit business, and its primary purpose is to stay in business, you know, just like any other business. So the information that they put out, you know, it is information that drives their business. And so, you know, we can look around and we can see the results of their business. You know, they are the third leading cause of death. Iatrogenic deaths is the third leading cause of death. You know, we can look at all of the chronic disease that we have, the epidemics of cancer and heart disease and diabetes. You know, these are all a direct result of following idea.
I agree with you in most of what you're saying. There's just been too many people that have died of infections who have chosen not to take antibiotics because of information. And that's not been helpful for a tremendous amount of people. So I respect the debate and the ideas, but there's a trend of people in alternative health circles dying from infection, not trying to deal with it without using antibiotics and things like that. And
no, and I understand that. I mean, that's most people come from this mindset, so it's very difficult to get over this hump of this misinformation that's been put into us for our entire lives. But you know, the one thing you have to kind of ask yourself is, antibiotic, what does the word mean? It means anti against bios life. The drug is against life.
Exactly.
It kills cellular life. Absolutely. So if the bacteria is created by the body,
that's the point of it. It kills the bacteria. That is absolutely
right.
The point.
But if the bacteria is proven to be your own healthy cells, and the antibiotic kills not only the bacteria, but everything that it touches, it kills your healthy cells as well. So you have to look at, well, what's the underlying cause that created this problem? So, you know, we see this information because this is what we've been taught. This is the mainstream information that's out there. And it's, you know, sometimes challenging to look at these things and look at them from a place that is, you know, more neutral, more, you know, understanding that, you know, there are different ways.
When you've known a number of people that have died from infection that didn't take action, then you start to consider this information a little bit, have a look into it in a different way as well. So I respect the
so let me ask you a question. If a body is sick, if a body is ill, how would applying a poison to the body, an ill body, create health?
If you have a bacterial infection in your body, and by taking a particular antibiotic, that bacteria is harmed or hindered and does not continue to spread and does not continue to do damage, and the body is and it does not kill you or harm you substantially, then that's how it acts. It acts in the bacteria.
But the bacteria has been proven to be a part of your body. So if the bacteria is created by the body, it's controlled by the body, is released by the body, the body's intelligence, its body's intelligent design has put this bacteria into place, then how does working against the body create a problem? You understand? Like, the germ theory, if I may finish, the germ theory is based on this premise that the bacteria is coming from outside the body. But we've proven that that's not the case. We've proven that MRSA is not coming from outside the body. It's found inside the healthy body at all times. Every sample, there's MRSA inside of a human body. Look at every single bacteria, they're found within the human body. So we know this now. We're starting to look at the bacteria within our digestive tract. We're starting to understand all of these things, you know, even in the mainstream science. So now we need to start thinking about, well, if we've got all of these people taking antibiotics, but people are getting are sicker than they've ever been before. People are getting, you know, cancer and chronic disease after taking bout after bout of antibiotics. You know, we've got studies now showing that antibiotics cause bowel cancer. So we have to start looking and saying, well, what is really going on here? And are we really, you know, if the body had created the bacteria for a specific purpose, how does killing that bacteria that was created by the body make sense? And so when we actually start to look at this, we start to look a little bit deeper, we start saying, okay, well, did the person really die from not taking an antibiotic, or did they die because they took an herb that was a poison, or did they take hydroxychloroquine or whatever, you know, the you know, kind of mainstream alternative is, that's a poison. Did that person die from a body created bacterial recycling process, something that is a natural process to our bodies? Did the body actually create its own death? Did the body actually kill itself? Or did the person put more poison in when the poisoned body was trying to clean poison? So we, you know, the body creates bacteria to address injury. So if the body is being poisoned and the body is being, you know, put into a state of disease, because that's what is disease? Disease is dis-ease, lack of ease. The body has been put into a state where it's not at ease. So the body is creating processes through our natural detox processes to clean and repair the incoming poison, right? So we eat something, we create a poisoned effect in the body creates bacteria to clean up that poison, to recycle the cells, and to create a new, you know, a new healthy organism. It expels the cells through our expulsion symptoms like coughing, sneezing, you know, mucus, runny nose, we expel out through the bowels, through the kidneys, and then, you know, all of those bad cells are out, and then the body is back in a state of health. So if the body is creating this detox process, then working against the body to stop the detox process doesn't make sense. Do you understand what I'm saying?
I understand the germ theory idea. I totally understand it. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's not something that's particularly new to me. And I've seen, as I've said, people have avoided taking antibiotics and have avoided doing things. And people have survived from major diseases by switching to a more natural diet and then become a victim of other things that could have easily been dealt with. And they decided to try and use the natural diet to deal with something that was not a diet-related issue.
Unfortunately, that is the way that, you know, the world kind of pushes this information. And so we look at things through a certain lens based on the, you know, the information being presented in a way that is, you know, fitting a certain model. And so unfortunately, a lot of people, you know, because of this model, even people within the natural health community are ingesting poisons or doing things that are extremely harmful to their body. You know, for example, how many people in the natural health world or the raw food world use enemas, use colonics? How many people use herbs? How many people eat garlic and ginger and turmeric? And, you know, I mean, I can go on all day listing all of the ways that even people in the raw food community are poisoning their body.
For sure.
You know, so we need to start understanding, you know, what is the body's, you know, what is the body saying to us when it's creating these symptoms? So when we're getting the cold and the flu, you know, why is the body having a detox reaction? Why is the body creating a cleaning process? You know, if we're injuring the body has to heal itself. The body, you know, and so even those of us eating, you know, raw fruits and things, you know, following a raw food diet are still making a lot of mistakes. You know, like I see, you know, Hildy passed recently, you know, and everybody's all like, you know, what happened?
Yeah.
And you know, and it's upsetting to people like me because we know what happened. You know, she's pushing, you know, liver cleanses and gallbladder cleanses and saunas and, you know, extreme fasting and dry fasting. All of these things are injurious to the body. They injure ourselves. And so, you know, we have all these people who are, you know, first of all, you know, Hilde came from a place of very deep disease and she healed a lot, but then she's also following things that are just extreme and go against our physiology. So, you know, even within the raw food world, we need to learn how our bodies work and we need to start learning, you know, how our cells function and how our biological processes function so that we can stop, you know, perpetuating these ideas of like speeding up detox or, you know, taking things that assist detox. You know, I think that's one of the most dangerous ideas that we have within the natural health community is this idea that we can control detox, that we can, you know, create detox. And detox is a process that the body is running 24/7. It is a completely body controlled process. And we have no influence over it. The only thing that we can influence is how much waste we are putting in, how much waste we are creating. And we do that predominantly through our diet. You know, we can do it through other lifestyle factors like smoking or, you know, living in an environment with, you know, polluted air and things like that. But, you know, the very large majority of that creating that cellular dysfunction is, you know, through the diet, what you're putting in your mouth three meals a day. And if you're ingesting things that, you know, your senses are telling you are toxic, you know, something that's bitter, spicy, you know, something that you wouldn't enjoy sitting down to an entire bowl full. Those are all things that are interfering with your cell's ability to survive. And so your body's going to have to keep cleaning up that mess. And you're going to, you know, like you were saying earlier about, you know, why you think that the lifespan, you know, our natural lifespan, that we're not going to reach 150 years, even if we put, you know, even if we put our newborn baby on fruits and they live entirely their entire life on the natural human diet, they're not likely to live to 150 years these days because, you know, we have been compounding all of these mistakes. And even when we're eating, you know, the natural diet, we're still perpetuating this idea throughout the natural health community that we can, you know, poison away our symptoms and we can, you know, take herbs to speed up detox or we can, you know, run down, you know, detox and create detox and all of these other ideas like going through saunas and hot and cold baths and all of these other things that stress the body. You know, if you've ever read the book by John Tilden, Toxemia Explained, you know, he talks about, you know, it's all about nerve energy. You know, we have a battery, we have a life, you know, we have a battery that we're born with. And some people are born with that battery charged up to 100%. And some of us are born with it charged to like 60%, you know, and some of us that have that 100% battery are out there, you know, eating terrible things and having terrible lifestyle habits and draining that battery really rapidly. And then you've got the people who are taking the 60% battery and, you know, eating their best food and living their best life and, you know, maximizing that. But that person with the 60% battery still might die younger than the person with the 100% battery because of what was passed down to them, all of the mistakes of the previous generation that were passed down to them. So, you know, we have to, you know, start learning how our cells function so that we can stop passing down all of these mistakes, even within the natural foods community.
Sure. So Lauren, how would people follow you, get in touch with you, find out more about you? Where would be the best place for them to stay in touch?
So the Terrain Model Refutes Germ Theory group on Facebook is a public group open to everybody. I'm also getting my website up. It's called therawkey.com. It's and then raw, R-A-W, and then key, K-E-Y. So I should have that up by the end of the week. Technically it's live. People can go there now, but there's not a whole lot of content on it, but I'm working very hard to try to get more content up there. You know, just, you can reach out to me on Facebook, you know, send me a message. I respond to everybody. It may take me a few days because I typically get, you know, 30 or 40 messages a day. So, but you know, it's like, I'm not, you know, like I'm just in this to help people get well and to, you know, make sure that people, you know, that we're helping ourselves and that we're helping the animals that are out there that need our help. So, you know, whatever I can do to kind of help guide people and help people find the right way, then, you know, I'm here to help.
Well, thank you very much for joining me today, Lauren. And yeah, everyone, I'll put some links below for the Terrain Model Refutes Germ Theory group. And you can find Lauren on Facebook as well. Thank you for joining us today, Lauren. Thank you, everyone, for watching and listening. Please feel free to share and reach out and comment and like this video or podcast, wherever you found it. Give us a rating if you like. And we'll see you next week in another episode of the Lovefoot Podcast. Thank you very much.